Best-selling author Isabel Allende turns her literary talents to a new genre.
Part of the duty of a mystery writer is to plant all the clues so that the reader can guess who done it. But at the same time, you plant red herrings to distract the reader, so that it's a game. Who is smarter, the author or the reader?
We talk with Allende about her latest novel and her first mystery, Ripper. It's about an appealing young sleuth who teams up with her grandfather and some online friends to solve a spate of murders in San Francisco. Then we rebroadcast our 2010 interview with Allende about her novel of revolutionary Haiti, Island Beneath the Sea. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Isabel Allende is one of the best-known writers in the Americas and the author of 20 books, including The House of Spirits, Maya's Notebook, and Island Beneath the Sea. But until now, she never tried her hand at the mystery genre. I admit, I was skeptical at first that she could pull it off. But as I was drawn into the multi-layered plot of her new novel, Ripper, it became clear that Allende has mastered the genre. It's also clear that she had a lot of fun writing the book. The action concerns a spate of murders in San Francisco. When people start turning up dead, a brilliant teenage sleuth named Amanda Jackson decides to use an online role-playing game to find what she suspects is a serial killer. But little does she know her own mother may be at risk. Here's what Ripper's publisher, HarperCollins, says about the characters. Quote, "The Jackson women, Indiana and Amanda, have always had each other. Yet while their bond is strong, mother and daughter are as different as night and day. Indiana, a beautiful holistic healer, is a free-spirited bohemian. Long divorced from Amanda's father, she's reluctant to settle down with either of the men who want her. Alan, the wealthy scion of one of San Francisco's elite families, and Ryan, an enigmatic, scarred former Navy SEAL. While her mom looks for the good in people, Amanda is fascinated by the dark side of human nature, like her father, the San Francisco Police Department's Deputy Chief of Homicide. Brilliant and introverted, the MIT-bound high school senior is a natural-born sleuth, addicted to crime novels, and Ripper, the online mystery game she plays with her beloved grandfather and friends around the world." That's from the publisher's description of Isabel Allende's new novel, Ripper. In the novel, her minor characters are as richly drawn as the major ones. And while Allende spins her hugely entertaining yarn, she also manages to touch on more serious issues like PTSD, the juvenile justice system, and mass surveillance. I spoke with Isabel Allende earlier this month. Isabel Allende, welcome again to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You have written so many books.
20 books.
20 books. From House of the Spirits to Maya's Notebook. But now this is the first book, Ripper, the first one that's actually a mystery. How did that happen?
It wasn't my idea. I can't take credit for that. In 2011, I told my agent that I wanted to retire, and she panicked. So she said, "No way," she said, "you have to write a book with your husband." And my husband is a mystery writer, William Gordon, and he has written several mysteries that have been translated, and Carmen Balcells is also his agent. And so she was very interested in this project. And Willie and I started to think about it. I start all my books by January 8th. And by January 7th, I realized that I was doing all the work. And it would never work because my husband writes in English. His attention span is more or less 11 minutes. I write in Spanish, and I can write for 11 hours. So I would end up doing all the work, and he would get half the credit. But then, no, this is not a good deal for me. And also, we were fighting a lot. He says that I'm really bossy, and it's really hard to live with me, but to work with me, it would be impossible. So Willie went to his room to write his sixth mystery, and I went to my room to write my first.
And you saved your marriage.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I don't want to inadvertently spoil anything, so I'd like to ask you to give our readers just a basic sense of the plot without giving anything away.
Oh, that's difficult. It's a complicated book that I didn't quite plan the plot as mystery writers usually do. I went like in circles. The story happens in 2012, and I was writing in 2012. So I was writing as the year was happening, and it happens in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, a place that I know very well, so I didn't need to do a lot of research. I attended a mystery writers conference to learn the craft and learn about murder, weapons, autopsies, poison, you know, all the stuff, which was very, very useful. And then I found the characters that I needed for my book. The plot is, the story is, there is a girl called Amanda Martin, who is the daughter of the chief of police in San Francisco. Her parents are divorced. She lives with her grandfather and her mother. And she plays online with friends that she has never met. They only meet online to play a game. And the game really exists. It's called Ripper. And the idea is that the players create a character, an avatar, and that represents them. And that character has skills and weaknesses, and according to those, they play the game. And the idea is to catch Jack the Ripper in London in 1888. So Amanda tells the kids that from now on, they will be playing the game placed in San Francisco in 2012, and they are going to try to catch a murderer or several murderers that are committing crimes in San Francisco. And she's aware of all this because of her father. So the whole plot is these kids, one step ahead of the police, and they are very creative, imaginative, and they are playing. They don't have the limitations, the red tape, the bureaucracy of the police. So they can catch the murderer much easier than the police, and that's the whole plot.
Mm. And it's a very detailed plot with many
characters. Yeah, it's a series of crimes that are very complicated.
And they were foretold. By somebody.
They were foretold by an astrologer. My idea with the book was it was tongue in cheek, really, because I don't read mysteries that much, and it's not my genre at all. But when I decided to write about it, I thought I'm going to try to write a novel that fits in the formula, that is a real mystery, but tongue in cheek. I'm making fun of the genre. And that was wonderful for me, the irony behind everything.
You had a lot of fun. I mean, it, not only making fun of the genre, but, you know, your characters, one of your main characters is almost like, you know, she would be a cliche, except that you really paint her in quite a deep way. But she's this bombshell, you know, of a massage therapist of all people.
Yeah. And she's a healer. I got real people to serve as models for my characters. For example, I know nothing about the military. I had to look for a Navy SEAL that was willing to be interviewed. And I went to Washington for 3 days and interviewed him extensively, saw pictures of battles, of his family, of everything, and he told me many stories. For Indiana, the character you're talking about, I have a model that is a healer that has been working on my husband, who was ill for almost 3 years, and now he's doing fine. So it did work for him.
Wow. Yeah, and you did incredible research. I mean, your characters really do have a depth. We should mention that the Navy SEAL, his name is Ryan. He is a love interest and more in the novel. It also gives you a chance to really go into some deeper issues. You know, there's always a little bit of politics in your book, and in this one you really do explore things like PTSD and the surveillance state.
Yeah, but when I write, I want to tell a story, and all stories are set in some kind of real world. And so unavoidably, social or political issues come up. Mm-hmm. But it's not my intention to give a message or to preach anything or to convince anybody about anything. Between the lines, you can find the person I am. That's every author is in the text. So it's easy to guess what are my feelings about the war or about politics in general. But that's not my intention to be preaching.
No, and I don't think you do at all. I mean, Ripper is an absolute delight to read, and but it's also interesting for you to go into some of those larger issues because you really situate your characters within a social context.
Well, that's the problem with this genre or with romantic novels and some other genres, that they are detached from the real world. So you have, for example, in a romance novel, you have this couple that makes love and that all the romance and all the tragedy, but nobody works. Yeah, and there's no political or social context. They don't live in the real world. So it's like a fantasy for adults. And with mysteries, it's the same. It's a formula that does not explore much the real world, like the thrillers. Mm-hmm. Now, it is different with some of the mysteries by Scandinavian authors. For example, the novels by Stieg Larsson or Joe Nesbø, they give us a picture of the darkness in Sweden or in Norway that we would never guess. We would never think that that exists there when you visit the country. So that, in that sense, I think it's very fascinating. I try to portray San Francisco as I know it.
And did you do a lot of reading of other thriller writers, other mystery writers, in order to prepare yourself for this, or is that just something you do anyway?
I do that usually, but in this case, I'm not a fan of mysteries. I had read mysteries when I was very young, like Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie, I mean the usual ones. But then for a long time, it was not something that I would read. But to prepare for this book, I read those Scandinavian authors and decided that that was not at all what I wanted to write, but I could make fun of them and of the genre in a way. And I think that what was most useful for my research was to attend that conference, which was, by the way, in a bookstore here in Marin County, in Book Passage. They have this conference every year, and I had not been particularly interested because it was not something that I was ever going to write. And so now I attended the conference and got in touch with the experts, the detectives, the policemen, the forensic doctors, the people who can really give me at least a reading list. And with that reading list, I could research for the book.
You even went to some psychopaths.
Yeah, I worked with a psychologist who had worked with serial killers. And so he had some experience in that. It was really interesting. And also, I know this place, the Bay Area, so I could find the places where the action happens, places that are unknown for most people in the Bay Area. And, for example, the place at the end, a sort of medieval castle, it really exists. And I could take pictures there, and now in my website there is a little YouTube about the place. So it's wonderful when the place and the time gives you so much. I really, really didn't have to exercise my imagination too much.
Well, it's pretty richly detailed. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Isabel Allende about her new novel, her first mystery. It's called Ripper. You know, I'm the kind of reader who doesn't like brutality. Give me a serious book that's really dark with lots of horrible, painful things that happen to it, and I don't really enjoy reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I do love a good murder mystery. And you write in the foreword of this book, with a note of glee, that you really enjoyed murdering people in this book. What is...
Because it's a fantasy.
Yeah, what is so satisfying about mysteries for the reader and the writer?
Well, it's the same satisfaction, I think, that readers find in romance novels. It's a predictable formula. You are never going to be disappointed. You expect something and you get it. I think that's the charm of it.
You said you have one character say in the book that the formula for crime thrillers is that, quote, evil is personified by a criminal who challenges justice and loses and gets his punishment, and then good triumphs and everyone is happy.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that the formula?
It's perfect. That was really great. Now, we've already mentioned some of your characters, and as always in your novels, Isabel Allende, and as always in your novels, in this novel, Ripper, has marvelous characters. There's the massage therapist or healer, Indiana Jackson, her daughter Amanda, her ex-husband Bob, Amanda's grandfather Blake.
I love Blake.
Yes,
the grandfather.
Talk about Blake, and I could so relate to him. He's just such a really warm and nurturing character.
In many of my books, there is no present father. The father is either dead or absent or distant or very severe, and he can't connect with the character. In this case, the father is divorced from the mother. He doesn't live with the girl, and he's very busy with, he's a womanizer also, he's very busy with his affairs and his job. And the girl, Amanda, who's 16, 17, she finds a father in her grandfather, and she has with him an extraordinary complicity. The grandfather plays the game, the Ripper game, with the kids. The kids don't know that he's an old man. They think he's another kid until they see him on Skype. And he is Amanda's henchman, and he obeys her orders. And so they have this complicity, this playing thing that is so wonderful. And in a way, I had that kind of complicity with my grandchildren when they were young. Now they're all in college and they have forgotten me. But but when they were younger, and especially the middle one, who is the model for Amanda, I had that kind of stuff, you know, that we could play games, mind games, and read and comment the reading and write together. It was just great.
And why are so many of the fathers absent or distant in your books?
You know, I didn't have a father. My father left my mother stranded in Peru with two babies, and she was pregnant of her third child. And he just went to a party and never came back. And my mother eventually ended up living in my grandfather's house. I was 3 years old. And my mother annulled the marriage. There was no divorce in Chile at the time. We never saw my father again. And my mother destroyed even the photographs. She never told us anything about him. We knew who he was. We knew the name, vaguely. But we had no idea what kind of person he was or what had happened. My mother never commented what had happened. And he just disappeared. So in my life, I had a grandfather that was a powerful figure and a wonderful stepfather, but he came to my life later. So in my first childhood, I didn't have a father figure. And maybe that's why I can't write about fathers.
Wow. And your real father never got back in touch with you?
No. Many years later, when I was almost 30, I was working as a journalist in Chile, and I was called to identify a body in the morgue. And I went, of course, very anxious because I thought it was my brother who had the same name as my father. I hadn't seen my brother for a while because he was in a cult. And I thought it was him. So I got to the morgue and they showed me a body that I had never seen. And I said, no, it's not my brother. It's not my brother. And then my stepfather came and my stepfather said, It's your father. He's your father. So I looked at him, and I couldn't identify at all with him. I didn't see anything familiar. I'd never seen a picture, but I was glad it wasn't my brother, and that's the only time I saw him.
Wow, what a story! So there's a mystery there that's at the heart of your own childhood. Is that something, you know, other even than the fact that so many of your characters don't have their father's present, just the very fact of mystery, is that something that drives your own kind of narrative impulse?
I don't know. I think that I'm very blessed with a dysfunctional family and a very unhappy childhood. Now I can write books because of that. So I'm really happy. When I see my grandchildren that had everything easy, I said, what are they going to write about? There's nothing to write about if your life has been easy. So I'm glad that at least I have all those stories to tell, and I have, in a way, used them in different ways, always in fiction, in all my books. Because my grandfather appears in the House of the Spirits, my grandmother, who was clairvoyant and spent her life experimenting with telepathy and calling the spirits in seances. I mean, with a grandmother like that, you don't need to invent anything, really. So it's great.
So, well, back to my question about characters. I mean, your characters are amazingly complex, and even the minor ones who are painted, you know, they're painted with deft little strokes, even if they just appear on a couple of pages. And this really struck me when we came to Judge Rachel Rosen, and I wanted to ask you, do you have the book there with you?
You want me to read something?
Yeah, I have it on page 196, but it would be the start of Tuesday the 7th, the very start of the chapter where you introduce Judge Rachel Rosen.
Can you give me a minute to find it?
Sure.
Okay, give me a minute.
Sure.
Just a sec. Tuesday 7th?
Yeah, and it starts on one page and, you know, it just goes down. It's just the first paragraph. And
the first paragraph,
it ends with, they did not deserve it. So it starts with that 8:15 and ends with that.
Yeah, just a sec. At 8:15 p.m., Judge Rachel Rosen parked her Volvo in the garage of the building where she lived. From the trunk, she took the heavy briefcase stuffed with the files she intended to read that evening, and a grocery bag containing tonight's dinner and tomorrow's lunch, a salmon fillet, broccoli, a couple of tomatoes, and an avocado. She had grown up in a frugal home and considered any unnecessary expenditure an insult to the memory of her parents, survivors of a concentration camp in Poland, who had come to America with nothing and worked hard to build a comfortable life. Judge Rosen bought exactly what she needed each day and wasted nothing. Leftovers from dinner she would have for lunch the following day, taking them in a Tupperware box to the juvenile court so she could eat alone in her chambers. She lived well, but allowed herself few luxuries and hoarded like a magpie in the hope that she would retire at 65 and leave off her savings. She had inherited the family furniture and her mother's modest jewelry, which was only of sentimental value. Her sole possessions were her penthouse apartment, a portfolio of shares of Johnson & Johnson, Apple & Chevron, and a savings account. She planned to spend every last cent before she died. She did not want her son and daughter-in-law enjoying the fruits of her work. They did not deserve it.
I just love that. I just thought I totally got that character just in one paragraph. If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Isabel Allende about her newest novel, her first mystery. It's Ripper. So now I figured out the whodunit somewhere around the middle of the book, and I'm not going to give out any spoilers here, but I was clued in by a seemingly undue emphasis given to a minor yet not quite fitting detail that was put at the end of a chapter. And I realized when I saw it that it is just the kind of note that in a seasoned mystery reader, you know, that you learn to pick up. And it was the first one of its kind in this book. Now, listeners, at this point in my conversation with Isabel Allende, I told her what the hint was. But since I don't want to spoil the suspense for you, I've edited that part out. So I wanted to ask you, you know, this was the first hint like this. Is this something you actually planted?
Yeah.
Oh, you did.
I mean, it's part of the duty of a mystery writer is to plant all the clues so that the reader can guess who done it, But at the same time, you plant red herrings to distract the reader, so that it's a game. Who is smarter, the author or the reader? Now, if you guessed by the middle of the book who was the murderer, I am really, really upset, because you are the only person that has done that.
You're upset?
Yeah. I mean, many people sort of thought that it was a certain person, and then it turned out that that person wasn't the real person. So there is also a sort of catch there. But I did plant the clues as I wrote, and then at the end, when I read the manuscript, I thought, how would this person know this? How would they reach this conclusion? And then I would have to plant some clue for the characters in the book, but also for the reader.
Right. Well, it seems to me that you were successful, and you made it hard enough so that most people would not maybe pick it up, but someone who is, you know, I've read a lot of mysteries in my life, and I read a lot of books, and it's just that little hint that, and I wasn't sure, but I got more sure as time went on. Now, there's a fair amount of good-natured spoofing of New Age culture, like astrology, crystal healing.
I live in San Francisco.
Yeah, I sensed affection there, but also a little bit of rolling of the eyes.
Yeah.
You start every book on January 8th?
Yeah.
And why? Why do you do that? Why that date?
Oh, my dear, I need discipline. If I didn't have a date to start, I would be procrastinating forever, because my life is really complicated. I have an office with several people working there. I have a foundation. My books are also published in Europe, so it's contracts, money, publishers. It never ends, plus press. And so I really need to find time for writing. And I have decided that January 8th is a perfect time. First of all, it's like Kabbalah for me, because I started my first book, The House of the Spirits, on January 8th, 1981. And it was such a lucky book that I have started all my books on the same date. And it's also winter. It's the end of the holidays. The kids are back in school or whatever. So it's a time for introversion, a time that I can just lock myself away and write.
Hmm. And have you started a new book this year?
Yes, I did. But because of the promotion of this book, that will be, I'm traveling to Europe on a book tour, and then several cities in the United States, I won't be able to go back to what I started until mid-February.
And you write like 10, 12 hours a day when you get going?
I write a lot. And when I'm not writing, I'm researching. And if I'm not researching, I'm sitting down, staring at the wall, thinking, what will happen next? Wow. So I live with the book inside. I dream about the book. I become the characters. That's the time of my life when everybody loves me, because I'm not there. I'm in my casita. I don't talk to anybody. And then I'm just adorable. As soon as I come out, everybody complains.
Well, I'm sure that that's not entirely true, but I completely enjoyed reading this book, Ripper.
Thank you.
And are you going to continue in, you know, which genre are you going to be taking up next?
It's not a mystery. And I don't know if I will ever write another mystery. It will very much depend on how I feel with this one. It's such a new thing for me, mm-hmm. that I'm still like, I don't know what I've done, truly. So I will wait a little. The book I started is not a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's like my other books, a book about characters and relationships.
And I look forward to that one. But this one was just absolutely terrific. I really enjoyed it. The mystery is Ripper. And we've been talking with Isabel Allende. And thank you so much for talking
to us. Thank you so much.
Isabel Allende's new novel and first mystery is Ripper. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt and watch the trailer for the book. Next up, we rebroadcast our 2010 interview with Allende about her novel, Island Beneath the Sea. It tells the story of a remarkable woman, the slave Tete, during the Haitian Revolution against French rule. Stay tuned.
Ouais, les fins n'est pas fini. J'aime te quitter, les pas de mal. Mais qu'on y aille à Calvin, plus grave. Que je sorti ou pas qu'à sortir. Toute la journée, on tendait ces blocodos. Gardez, yo, prends un pays, moi. Yo, v'lez faire les tout nos terrains de chasse. Aider tout le monde à cache-cache. Tim qui compte sa privé.
Ouais,
petit
pays, ouais, Haïti. Ça fait longtemps depuis le power.
Et les hauts,
ça me fait moins mal.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It was just over 4 years ago that Haiti suffered the most devastating earthquake in its history. When the earthquake struck, evangelist Pat Robertson laid the blame at the feet of the Haitian people, implying that in overthrowing their French colonial slave masters in the 18th century, their forebears had made a pact with the devil, and the earthquake was God's revenge. Robertson's wacko commentary was a reminder of how deep and long-lasting is the rage of the rulers against those who dare to free themselves from their rule. Haiti's revolution still remains unique in world history as the only successful slave rebellion. Just a few months after the Haiti earthquake hit in 2010, Isabel Allende came out with a sweeping historical novel, Island Beneath the Sea, that brought the era of Haiti's rebellion against French rule alive for the reader. It tells the story of the slave Tété, a woman born into slavery in the colony of Saint-Domingue. Rich in historical detail, Island Beneath the Sea explores several themes: the toll slavery takes on both the oppressed and the oppressor, the melding of different cultures in the cauldron of colonialism and revolution, and the deep personal relationships that persist in spite of the rigid social barriers of slave society. Let's listen to my 2010 conversation with novelist Isabel Allende. Isabel Allende, it is such a pleasure to be talking with you here on Writer's Voice. Your latest book, Island Beneath the Sea, first of all, I'd just like to ask you, where does the title come from?
The book is the story of the slave revolt in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti. And it's the story of a person who, a slave who is born there, and then the second part of the book happens in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, the slaves in Haiti had only two ways of liberation: death and escaping. Many escaped, and of course many were killed too. The life in the plantations was horrible, and they thought that when they died, their souls would go to the island beneath the sea. And that was Guinea, paradise, because they had come by sea, and many of them had been kidnapped in Africa and had never seen the ocean before. And they thought the only way back to the old life, to paradise, to Africa, would be to go to the island beneath the sea.
As you say, this is a story of a slave. She is a remarkable character, Tété. Tell us about her.
The book begins when she's 9 years old and she's sold to a plantation owner. And she's supposedly to be the handmaid of the wife of the plantation owner, who is Spanish, and she is mad. Many European women who married people in the colonies, men in the colonies, and were taken to these very isolated places, the plantations, went mad. They couldn't stand the weather, they couldn't stand the mosquitoes, and the climate of terror in which everybody lived. The slaves, because they had terrible lives, and the whites, because they feared that they would be poisoned, assassinated, that there would be a rebellion. The slaves were revolting all the time, so it was not as if life was easy for the whites either. It was a horrible life for everybody.
Yes, you really do go into the impact of the intertwined relationships, the dependence of the whites upon their slaves. emotional as well as physical or financial, and the tremendous toll that it takes psychologically on people.
Yes, there is a point in the book after the slave revolt when the whites have to escape, and the master, Tete's master, who is called Toulouse Valmorin, takes her and the children to New Orleans. And there he buys another plantation. But there the conditions of the slaves is very, very different, because in Saint-Domingue they were disposable. They were so cheap that the idea was to exploit them to death. So in 4 or 6 years in the fields they would die and they would be replaced. And that was economically more sound than humane treatment. However, in Louisiana, the trade, slave trade, was already forbidden. So slaves became very expensive. Therefore, it was an investment of capital. There were also rules about the treatment of slaves, and people didn't accept cruelty very easily. It wasn't at all the life in the plantation. So the life of Tete, so, and of the slaves that were taken with the masters to New Orleans changed dramatically when they arrived there. And there's a point in the book when Toulouse Valmorin buys a new plantation and the rules of the game are different, and he gets an overseer who is a kind man. And he feels relieved because he feels that the absolute power that he had over the people in the plantation in Saint-Domingue tested his humanity constantly. And he was a man that was against slavery at the beginning, and then when he becomes the plantation owner, he has to deal with the problem. And the other thing is that we know in the book, although he doesn't say it, that he loves Tete. He's attached to her, and he will not emancipate her, although he owes her her emancipation, because he doesn't want to lose her. So in the book there is all these connections that people had that were family connections often. And of course there's the horror of rape and incest and everything else, but nothing is simple in these relationships. They were very complex, complicated.
And in discovering that, because it's evident that you did prodigious research in this book, it is just a marvelous view into this time. In doing this, how did you discover this kind of this fraught relationship between master and slave? I mean, after all, Valmorin, you're right, he was against slavery to begin with, and then he was in favor of it. When it comes time for Tete to declare her independence to him and really demand what is due her because she had saved his life and the life of his children, he's outraged.
He doesn't understand why she's not grateful. Why she, they have lived together 40 years or 30 years. And Valmorin thinks of her as his property, but also as part of his family. He's attached to her and depends on her. And so he doesn't understand why she doesn't feel the same way toward him. He feels betrayed when she wants her freedom. You know, for me, it wasn't that difficult to imagine all this, because I come from a country where there was practically no slavery. We didn't have plantations in Chile, and we didn't have African slaves, but we enslaved the indigenous people, the Indians. And Chile is a very class-oriented society. And I grew up in an environment where people were divided by classes. And that kind of relationship in which you have, for example, the nanny that brings up the children at home, and she's treated, she doesn't eat at the table with you, she often doesn't eat the same food. She lives in a room in the back of the house that is almost a cell. I'm talking, of course, about the 50s. It isn't that way anymore in Chile at all. This has changed completely. But this is how I was brought up. And this was natural. And for me, it was never natural. I was 5 years old and I could see that there was something basically wrong. And when the nanny would say, I'm fed up, I'm leaving, the family would feel betrayed. She was a member of the family. She had brought up the children. She was like a mother for the children. Why on earth would she leave? Why would she want a life of her own? She already has a life here. So I do understand how these things work.
And one of your characters in the book, the son of Valmorin, also feels the same way, even as a child. And in doing so, he has a very personal reason, because his half-sister is Tete's, the daughter of Tete and Valmorin.
Yes, so these two kids are siblings. They are half brother and sister, and they are in love. They have been brought up together. They are from different races. They love each other, and then as they get older, the love turns into a sexual love also. And it's very interesting, because in that time, rape was a crime only if the woman was white. Incest was a crime only if the two people involved were white. But if you raped, if a white man raped a woman of color, that was not a crime. That could not be prosecuted. And if he had relationships with his daughter of color, it wouldn't matter at all. And often siblings had relationships because they were not brought up as siblings. One of them was property. All this makes these relationships fascinating and terrible. So when we look at the problem of racism today in places that have been slavist states like the United States, we have to understand where we come from in order to understand the resentment and the hatred that the African American community has, or how broken the African American community can be when you have, not long ago, this kind of relationship with the whites.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Isabel Allende about her latest book, Island Beneath the Sea. And we're talking with her right here in the offices of HarperCollins, which has published the book. And as you say, these relationships are complex, these relationships of color, also between the free blacks and the slaves. Tell us about what was it like in Haiti? I mean, it seems that the free blacks really occupied a position almost as enforcer in between whites and slaves.
Well, there were 60 shades of color, and each one had a name, depending on how much white you had in your background. The three main classes in Saint-Domingue were the Grand Blanc, which were the rich white plantation owners, the Petit Blanc, which were the civil servants, the military, the French people, but had no money, and the Affranchis. And the Affranchis were free people of color. Usually the father was a white person and the mother was either a mulatta or an African woman. And the father would have emancipated them and usually giving them some resources and education. And usually they had a better situation, economic situation, than the Petit Blanc. They had no political power, but they had economic power, and they controlled the trade, the commerce. Often they had plantations too, they had land. And the Petit Blanc and the Affranchis hated each other. The Petit Blanc were very resentful for the fact that these people of color had more than they had. The Affranchis never identified with a slave mother, always with the white father who had the power. So they tried to be as white as possible. And often they were more brutal to the blacks than the whites. So an Affranchis, a free person of color, had the obligation to serve in the militia. In La Marechaussee, they had to serve for 2 years at least. So they often became the military and the enforcers and the militia, that they would be the ones in charge, for example, of chasing the blacks, the fugitives. They were always the enforcers.
And even then, Tete's own daughter, Rosette, resents her. She would be one of these Affranchis, although she really doesn't. She only becomes liberated by virtue of her mother's action.
Yes, Rosette would be a quadroon, and she's a slave because she's born from a slave mother. She needs to be emancipated to be free because by birth she's a slave. And she resents her mother because she's sent to a school where, although she looks almost white, and she becomes a Catholic. She has all the education of a young lady. She identifies, as children usually do, with the powerful. And she sees her mother as uneducated, darker, poor, a slave. So she doesn't want to be like her mother.
Enya Tete is certainly someone to look up to. She, in spite of her circumstances, is able to become educated as a healer and plays a very powerful role within her family, within the family, which is the only one she knows, the one of Val Morin's.
She's very powerful because the wife of Val Morin dies very soon when Maurice, the child, is very young. So she brings up the child as her own. She's like much more than a mistress to Val Morin. She runs his household. She advises him in everything. He asks for her advice. She is his companion. And in a way, she has the role of a wife. But the difference is that she doesn't love him. And she is all the time, she's obsessed with her own freedom and the freedom of her children. But she is powerful, of course, because she has the knowledge of the land, the plants, relationships. She's very smart. And she's a very, she has a lot of common sense. And she's a woman who is very self-contained, very quiet. She observes and she acts accordingly. I just love her. I wish I was like her, with that incredible inner power. Her spirit is so strong.
I felt your love for her character so much that there are many places in the book where you could have chosen to have misfortune turn into real tragedy for her, and she skirted it each time. And I wondered whether it was because you couldn't bear to have the worst happen to her.
Partly, but I think the worst happens to her when she loses her daughter. And she loses her daughter in such an unfair and awful way. But I did not have her flogged. She loses her lover, too. So she has a lot of losses in her life, but she achieves what she most wanted, which is freedom for herself and her children.
There's another powerful woman in the book as well, Violette. Tell us about her and what was her social station?
Violette would be in Haiti, in Saint-Domingue, a quadroon, and she was beautiful. There was a class of courtesans that were free women of color, usually very were trained in the art of love and chosen among the most beautiful. And they were very attuned to French fashion and French refinement. And they were the courtesans of the cities mainly. And they made a living with this kind of high-class prostitution for a very short time, because they would start around 14, and by age 20, 25, they were already considered old. But Violette is a very smart one, and she has a companion, and the companion is an African slave, a woman who is like a mother to her, and like a pimp also, her manager. And these two women are really powerful. And eventually they end up also in New Orleans, where she becomes a very important person in that society of free people of color in New Orleans that were living in a sort of golden era for that group of people that later changed when, after the Louisiana Purchase, when the Americans took over, the racist laws were much stricter and it was much more difficult to liberate a slave. And so the conditions for the blacks were really worse. But there was a time when you could send the boys to be educated in France, the girls in the Ursulines, they owned property, they had professions. It was a brilliant time.
So you're really saying that slavery in French Louisiana was not quite as bad, that slaves had more rights because France itself had gone through a revolution in which slavery was outlawed. And yet it was much worse in the United States then?
In the United, it's interesting because the governor that was the first governor in after the Louisiana Purchase in New Orleans, Claiborne, did not own slaves and he was against slavery. But he lived in a country that was slavist, and so when these 10,000 refugees came to New Orleans in the turn of the 18th century, they brought with them their white families and their domestic slaves that they trusted, and of course their mistresses of color and their children of color. And Claiborne, the American governor, didn't know what to do with these domestic slaves because he feared that they would contaminate the other slaves in the United States to imitate a revolt like the one they had in Saint-Domingue. So that was the fear of the whites. They always fear a slave revolt. And because slave trade had been outlawed in the United States and because slaves were so expensive, there was all this conflict about property, about this is my property, why do you intervene? And Claiborne put many of them in jail because he didn't know what to do with them. And so there was all this conflict. But soon enough, let's say, the American laws against the blacks were much harder than the Spanish and the French.
We're talking with novelist Isabel Allende about her latest book, Island Beneath the Sea. It takes place around the time of the Haitian Revolution against the French and is the story of the slave Tété, who wins her freedom through her remarkable resilience and courage. And you're saying that slave trade was outlawed in the United States or in New Orleans under the French at this time?
No, in the United States. So there was trade, but black market. For example, the Pirates of the Caribbean would, after the success of the revolution, when they created the nation of Haiti, which was the first independent Negro republic in the world, the generals that succeeded, that came after Toussaint Louverture, Dessalines, Christophe, started selling their own people to the Pirates of the Caribbean, who in turn would sell them in the Delta in the Mississippi. So it was not legal to have a slave market, but there were illegal slave markets in some places.
You just mentioned something that really struck me as well. It seemed to me that the revolt, which was undertaken at such tremendous cost to those who undertook it, I mean, the incredible danger that they faced and the struggle, that became corrupted in some way. Tell us a little bit about that, and what are your thoughts on how that happened or why that happened?
Well, first of all, the people who lived in Haiti were not Africans all from the same place. They came from different places in Africa. They spoke different languages. There were different races, different religions. And the only thing that kept them together was their obsession with freedom. And religion, voodoo, helped a lot because it gave some coherence to the movement. But it was betrayed first by its own generals because they needed to keep the plantations going, and they had liberated the slaves. So they forced people into what they call the military, but the military, one-third of the military was in the plantations working the fields for free, under overseers. Then it became very corrupt. And then people who were lighter in color, the affranchis, are the ones who were ruling the country. There was great corruption from the very beginning, great violence also, but also, it was boycotted or sabotaged by the other nations around, France to begin with, and all of Europe, and the United States, that didn't want the slave revolt to happen in the United States. So it was always against Saint-Domingue, and also later in history, it has occupied Haiti several times.
You mentioned the role of voodoo, and that's very, very important in the book. I wonder if you could say something about what this meant to you in writing this book. This whole, after all, you come from a tradition of magical realism in Latin American literature. Talk a little bit about what this meant in the writing of the book for you.
Well, voodoo is a very interesting religion. To begin with, we tend to think of it as superstition, as we think of any religion that is not ours. What we believe is a religion. What other people believe is superstition or magic realism. I started to learn about this when I did the research, and I was really very impressed. Voodoo has one God only, which is Papa Bon Dieu, and then it has the Loas. The Loas, or the Orishas in Brazil, are the like a little bit like the saints in the Catholic Church, but much more powerful. As a human being, we cannot be in touch with God directly, but we can be in touch with these Loas. And the difference is that there is no church, really. So the practitioner in the ceremonies, in trance, with the drums and the dancing and in trance, they are mounted by the Loas. There are several different Loas that have different characteristics. And when the practitioner is mounted, you become the Loa. For example, a young woman could become Legbe and be this old man all twisted and crippled during the trance. When they wake up from the trance, they don't remember what happened. They may have been doing extraordinary things like putting burning coals in their mouth or things like that, and they don't remember. But they feel the empowerment, the empowerment of being in touch with the divine, which I think some people achieve with drugs, maybe, or some saints in ecstasy. But it's a very rare thing. Very few people can experience that. And for these slaves that had no power whatsoever and whose lives were horrible, the empowerment of the Loas gave them superhuman courage. And when they fought in battle with machetes and whips against the cannons of Napoleon, the best trained troops in Europe, and they defeated them, they were accompanied by the souls of the dead that had risen from the island beneath the sea. They were empowered by the Loas. They were united by this incredible spiritual strength. So I have to have great respect for what happened, and for voodoo too. I don't think this is magical realism. This is what happens when people have a spiritual belief.
Isabel Allende, your wonderful novel, Island Beneath the Sea, has just come out. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much.
Author Isabel Allende. After our interview, Allende told me that throughout the time she was doing research for Island Beneath the Sea, she suffered from stomach pain. It turned out to be caused by secondary trauma from reading about the extreme brutality of the slave system in Haiti. Once the book was finished, the pain went away. That was my 2010 interview with Isabel Allende about her novel Island Beneath the Sea. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.